Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today originally aired in November of 2015. Today you'll hear the final part of a recent interview with author and journalist Andrew Craig. His latest book is Presidential Puppetry, and his website is justice-integrityproject.org. So let's begin with the final part of the interview.
So, for example, the theory was, why did Oswald kill Kennedy? And people say, oh, he's a lone nut. He wanted to be a big shot. He must have hated Kennedy and was involved with the communists. He went to Russia or Soviet Union at that time. Well, here's something. You're very well informed, Cheryl. We've been working on this stuff for a couple of years now. Very few people know that Oswald, the loner, the misfit, that he worked on all kinds of sensitive projects before and after his Soviet Union time.
I only knew that from reading the book recently, Dr. Mary's Monkey.
Oh, yeah.
Which I would highly recommend to anybody. Yeah, and from that, I learned about the very Baker woman. What's her first name?
Yeah, Judith.
Judith.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about her and Oswald and their connection.
Yeah, I'll be glad to. And I'll get to that in just a second. I'll just say that in a timeline, Oswald was a U.S. Marine working in Japan. He worked on the super secret U-2 spy plane project as a radar technician. Now, this is incredibly secret efforts to fly over China and Russia at high altitudes and take spy photos. And nobody knew about this. And so this is Oswald before he goes to the Soviet Union. And he also learned Russian and was able to speak almost like a native. And you think, well, wait a second, if the guy's so stupid and such a loner and such an incompetent, how do you learn how to speak Russian when you're in the U.S. Marines working on a spy program? He had to have gone to the language school. And then you find out that there's a false defectors program that was operative at that time, where we would send people who would pretend to be defectors to the Soviet Union to engage in little spy versus spy games. And, you know, it's not 100% certain, but it looks like Oswald was part of that and that the Russians weren't buying it. So they said, thanks for defecting. Here, you can go to work in the factory. And that at some point, he let it be known he wants to go home. And U.S. taxpayers paid for him to come back. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to work for a series of very conservative companies. So, for example, the Texas Book Depository was owned not by the state, which you might think from the name, but by a private defense contractor. So he's working for a defense contractor. Just before that, he had worked for a coffee company in New Orleans during the summer of 1963. And there he was passing out communist literature, and that all adds to the image, well, he must love the communists, and maybe that's why he killed Kennedy. But then it turns out that this coffee company, the Riley Coffee Company, was owned by another extremely conservative guy who was part of the intelligence, the anti-Castro, the pro, what we call it, exile community. And so here's Oswald working there by day, handing out communist literature in his spare time. And
unbelievable.
But the public only knows the part of him doing stuff to promote the communists. And he didn't really seem to have any allies in this. He's just kind of doing it. And all of this goes into the Warren Commission report and the theory, well, we don't know why he killed the president, but look at this crazy guy trying to advocate for Castro down in the heart of the South. So again, to get more to your questions or your reference, Dr. Mary's Monkey, there's this book by the son of a famous doctor at Tulane who always wondered about his father's life story as an eminent medical researcher in New Orleans during this time period. And so Edward Haslam, who's a talented writer, creates this biography of his father's life, and he basically portrays his father as having a secret life where he's doing medical experiments for the CIA and working with a quite eminent cancer researcher, Dr. Mary Sherman, on developing fast-acting cancers to be used for Lord knows what, but probably assassination efforts. And Haslam then discovers that a woman named Judith Ferry Baker, who you also mentioned, and she's written a couple of books. One is Me and Lee, I think it's called. I've got them both here. And she says she was the secretary at this Riley Coffee Company, and part of her job was to make it look on the time records like Oswald was working there all the time when he was actually partly helping these medical experiments. And she says further that the reason she was the secretary there was she was very interested in cancer research and was going to go to Tulane, but was too young to go to their medical school. And they said, well, work at the coffee company and you can work on the medical experiments. And that she was working with Oswald on these medical experiments, partly just feeding the experimental rats and cleaning the cages. And that she fell in love. They had an affair for that summer before the assassination, but she was already married. And she then, after the assassination, got scared, moved to Europe, was frightened out of her wits, and only recently came forward. And she's enjoyed some success. She's actually one of the creators or key people at this conference I'm speaking at. And I'll also say that some other researchers don't believe her. They don't think she's got enough records. They think she's amplifying her story, and that even if she worked with Oswald, which I think she clearly did, she's got some records showing that she's at the coffee company, and he was. But it's a controversy within a historical controversy about how much she knew, even though her books are quite long and detailed. And maybe I'll also say I know her. I know the arguments. I and some of the other speakers were under pressure not to speak there because some researchers really don't like her and think it taints the whole research community. But my view is that this kind of research has too many of these feuds. They're basically counterproductive, and that I'm responsible for what I say, not what somebody else at a conference says.
Right. But I think it makes sense because just like the media is so infiltrated, so are our groups, the research groups. So if she's saying something that might be very valuable, then there are going to be people who are going to discredit her. And then on the other hand, she may be somebody who's just wants some attention or something, which I doubt. But so you never know. And I think you're right that it creates, and that's what they want, is to create dissension amongst the researchers. So I think it's important to just, as you said, focus on your own, what you're doing, and do your best.
Yeah. And the other thing is, but as I look at my bookshelf, here's Dick Cheney's memoirs, here's Carl Rove's memoirs, and many others. And I think, well, wait a second, does nobody think they're leaving anything out of their memoirs? Or right. That they might be recreating a conversation that, you know, even Einstein couldn't remember, a verboten conversation. And so it's an extreme example because she resurfaces with claims of an affair or with a very famous person. But on the other hand, to me, just because Carl Rove's memoirs are published by a big publishing house doesn't...
They're not any more truthful than...
Right.
right. There's no guarantee of that. Yeah, no, and we know we're infiltrated. I mean, obviously, if they went to all the trouble to do the phony Warren Commission and the phony 9/11 Commission and all that, they're going
Let's
to...
Let's not forget the museum.
And the museums, too, both of them, even the 9/11 Museum. So if they go to all the trouble to do that, of course they're going to infiltrate our groups and try and create problems. And I see it on the email lists and things. There are definitely people there who are there to disrupt. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, that's what they do, and I think they're pretty successful at it. And we just have to learn how to work around that, I guess, as best we can. But can you tell me, is there any kind of consensus in the JFK research community on who did it?
No. And let's define our terms so a little bit, though. First of all, the community includes exactly some of the provocateurs that you're talking about.
Right.
So it's impossible to get them to agree to anything that might have happened because they're paid to disagree and be disruptive. So I guess implicit in your question is, among people I think are reasonably honest, is there a consensus? And I still say no on a lot of the specifics because, contrary to popular belief, this kind of research is not well paid. In fact, like 9/11 or other research, mostly a volunteer effort by people who, the closer they get to the truth, the more they find their markets are cut off because, you know, after what we said about CBS, PBS, The Nation magazine, they're not going to publish and help. And most of them don't have any money anyway. I mean, in fact, a friend of mine was just telling me about one of the most famous talk shows, how cheap they were on the guest fees. So a lot of this is a Potemkin village made to look more reliable than it is. But to get back to the point, there's over 2,000 books on the Kennedy assassination. And so arguably the authors, most of whom are critics of the Warren Commission, but each one has their niche and their pet theory. Oh, the mafia did it, or the CIA did it, or Lyndon Johnson did it. So it's not only a labor of love to justify their book or movie and idea, but it's part of their whole personality. That's probably, if we could talk to their families, they'd be all-consuming. The mafia did it people are the rivals of the Johnson did it people. And I know this because 2 years ago, Cheryl, I decided to have a forum because that was the big 50th anniversary of the killing. I was looking at what was going on and I thought, I got to get to the bottom of this. This is really when I started the Reader's Guide, listing the 500 most important books and so forth, because I was trying to work it through myself at first by just doing a catalog of the different theories. And then ultimately to get to what I think happened. But I organized a thing at the National Press Club, and I brought in about five major authors and researchers, including Jerry Corsi, a conservative who wrote a book saying Lyndon Johnson did it or orchestrated it, Dan Moldea, who's an organized crime writer who adamant that the mafia did it, and some others in between. So we had a great discussion. It's also the night I announced my book, Presidential Puppetry. So I was kind of combining a few things because that deals in part with President Obama's fear that he might get killed too. I mean, if nobody cares that much about Kennedy, why would they care about him being killed?
Right. Now, with all the different, some people saying it was the mafia, some people saying it was Johnson or whoever.
Yeah.
In the Martin Luther King trial that came out in 1999 that nobody knows about because the media have censored that, it did come out that there were a lot of people working together. So there was the mafia, the military.
Oh, exactly.
You know, so is that part of what's happening here?
In fact, you've anticipated my punchline here because the thing was, I think, started at 6 o'clock. And it was supposed to end at 9 o'clock, but nobody wanted to leave. It was so interesting. In fact, Tom DeLay, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Texan, he'd left under an indictment, but he came to the thing, and he was staying, like everybody else, you know, right to the end. And in fact, it was still going strong at 10 o'clock, an hour after it was supposed to end. And I thought, well, so I got up, but I said, we got to end this. But as a question to each of you, you've all got different ideas of who did it. And by the way, just set up the drama a little bit, Cheryl. Two of the people literally hated one another because of their different ideas.
Wow.
I'd heard that, but I didn't realize that they really hated each other. Mm. Put them right next to each other. But so now that I've set the drama, we got Tom DeLay and a packed house, and everybody's got a different theory. I said, okay, we got to end this. Does anyone disagree with the idea that it could have been Lyndon Johnson, the CIA, the mafia, and the Cubans? And nobody disagreed. Just as you said, each could have had a role. And if you think of multiple shooters, well, who knows better how to kill people than the mafia?
Right.
But who hated Kennedy more than the Cuban exiles?
Right, and I think that they almost have to do it that way for to protect themselves, because in the end, then nobody's going to kind of rat out the other people or point the finger because they were all involved in it. So they all have to work to keep it covered up?
Well, yeah, except they don't necessarily trust each other to keep secrets. And so yet another book I would recommend is a book called Hit List, which I have right here by Richard Belzer, the famous TV star, and David Wayne. And it's a list of approximately 50 people who knew too much and who died. I don't know why I'm laughing, nervous laughter. But you find some amazing stories of people who went bye-bye, who were a little close to the action. Do you remember, for example, Dorothy Kilgallen?
Yes.
What do you recall about her?
Well, I know that she was writing an article about, I think, Jack Ruby. Wasn't she interviewing him or something?
Yeah, you're up on all of
that. And then she mysteriously died, or did she commit suicide? I don't know the details. Maybe you can fill us in on the details there.
Well, she's one of the 50 people. And just to set the scene, she was a pioneering newspaper woman who went from beyond the women's pages at the time to be one of the most widely quoted columnists in the country. And she was also famous because she was on a TV program, popular TV program, What's My Line? And her distinction was that she got the only interview of anybody in the world with Jack Ruby. And she got his story that he had tried to tell to the Warren Commission, but they really didn't want to hear it. And so here he is in the Dallas jail, and he'd been convicted, and he sent a message to the Warren Commission. I'll tell you the full story, but you got to get me out of Dallas because I can't tell it here. And they wouldn't bring him out. Now, they did go down and talk with him, and I'm sure he's looking over his shoulder because, you know, he either doesn't tell them much or they don't say much about any of this. So there he is. They don't want to hear. And so somehow Dorothy Kilgallen arranges to get his story, and she writes a book about it, and she gives a copy of the book to her best friend, and then she does What's My Line, and she goes out for a drink with some of her buddies in New York and says how excited she is that she's got the Ruby story done, and it's going to change, I'm paraphrasing here, it's going to change America's view of history. And then she goes home, she writes her column for her newspaper, and as usual, the messenger comes at 1:30 a.m. and picks it up. And then suddenly she's dead, ruled a suicide.
Yeah, there's lots of
found in a bed she didn't use, and all dressed up with her eyelashes in a bed, reading a book that she'd already read. And according to this book, Hit List, massive overdoses of drugs, and not to be too crude here, but no other way of saying it, that like the death of Marilyn Monroe, also chronicled in another book by Richard Belzer called Dead Wrong, to the average person in the public, or at least superficial reader, you've got these famous people who take an overdose of drugs, and,
right,
you know, that's too bad. But here's the crude part, is apparently if you take massive, massive amounts of drugs, you throw up. And it's not just, gee, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to take all these drugs, but I don't want to dirty the sheets, you know.
Right.
So I refuse to throw up. No, it's an involuntary thing. And for both of these women, there were not the telltale signs of drugs.
Right. And then we have Jack Ruby later dying of cancer, and then we know they were experimenting with how to give people
cancer.
Well,
exactly.
So, yeah.
He suddenly got cancer, and he had actually, part of his complaint had been, I think they're poisoning me here.
You present really fascinating information. I know you've started to do a little bit of research into 9/11, so I just wondered if you saw any similarities.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's huge. One little footnote, both copies of Dorothy Kilgallen's book disappeared from the face of the earth, including the one that she'd given her friend, but also the one in her house. So I say that as a prelude to 9/11, and it all goes back to the original point that as we try to think about our mysteries today, the JFK death and that of related circumstances, they're mind-opening to what possibilities are today on 9/11 or other things. And when those of us who research 9/11 raise anything, as you know, people say, well, none of this is possible. The newspapers and TV stations would report it, but who in government would even conceive of doing anything bad? And there's two ways to respond. One is to try to take a look at 9/11 evidence, but it's such a recent and emotional topic for many people that it's almost impossible for many people to make headway. And that's why it's useful to have a knowledge of something that would be even, well, I won't try to compare the two in terms of the horridness, but the average person would think, well, gee, I can look at records a little more dispassionately about something that happened 50 years ago. And the type of things that we're talking about now, you know, people can look at. Everything that I said here, people could easily look up.
It's well documented, yeah.
It's totally well documented. Yeah. And by now, we're getting evidence on 9/11, but we certainly don't have 3 million pages of it. But we also know the pattern. Appoint the Blue Ribbon Commission, which doesn't really look at things.
Right.
It has people involved who either are
deeply
compartmentalized
connected,
or ambitious or don't know where to look or they're not authorized to look, and then just say, well, a commission looked at this and closed the books. So it's not just these two situations either, because we also have the example of other assassination attempts.
Right.
And
the Oklahoma City bombings, all of that.
All of it of greater or lesser degree of records. And my view, for what it's worth, is establish the facts on the Kennedy assassination. Let me go back. I didn't quite answer your question. Very, very quickly, you said, is there a consensus? And maybe I was too deep in the weeds in saying no.
Uh-huh.
But let me say, there's at least 7 or 8 people who have confessed to shooting Kennedy. And one is getting out of prison this spring. His name is James Files. And the Daily Mail in London just wrote a story about him yesterday. He's still bragging about killing Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of us don't believe him. But there's ample evidence to get to my bottom line that the CIA orchestrated this, used people in the mob and Cuban exile community, and it was at the really behest of what I call the puppet masters, other people might call Wall Street oligarchs and segregationists and others, and that ultimately you can make the argument who was the trigger people of these 7 or 8 people who have confessed or are implicated, but it doesn't matter that much on that level of detail. It doesn't even matter whether Johnson was in on it or whether he just orchestrated the cover-up. I try to operate at a little higher level of generality and say the important thing is our media and academics, with a great exception of the University of Hartford, Professor George Michael Ivica,
yeah,
a few others, what a wonderful books he wrote there on this for many years. And the important thing is we know that the official story isn't right. And some of the specifics, until there's a grand jury or a truth commission, are going to be a little vague, but that's not the important thing.
There's a new movie out called The Truth. It's about Mary Mapes and Dan Rather,
yes,
and how they got canned from,
yes,
working at CBS because they were investigating President George W. Bush's being AWOL during his military service. And there was a guy in the New York Times who wrote a review of it, and he starts it out with, for some conspiracy theorists, even the Warren Commission report is not enough to satisfy them. And I thought that was interesting that they have to put that out there. And isn't it the polls show that like over 80% of Americans don't believe the Warren Commission? And
well, it's varied. I think it reached a high watermark around the time that Oliver Stone's movie, which was largely accurate in my view, came out about 22 years ago. And there it was in the 80%. It depends on how the question is framed, but it's consistently at least the 60% level and well over 50%. And so this is a case of why democracy is good, because the ordinary person doesn't believe this stuff. And yet one of my JFK Reader's Guide stories looked at the coverage of the 50th anniversary in the New York Times and every other main publication. While they might do little feature stories that mention the conspiracy theories and the alternatives, bottom line, they're all in favor of the Warren Commission, which can't be right and illustrates that they can't be trusted on whether it's covering the budget, Donald Trump,
right.
Syria or 9/11. I mean, they just can't be trusted until they honestly look at something as obvious as the Kennedy assassination. Now, going to Dan Rather and Mary Mapes, I followed that very, very closely. I treated it in my book, Presidential Puppetry. I'm on their side. I've got their books on it. I think I know from one of my sources how they were set up, how mm-hmm. it was done. And I think I know things about that that maybe even they don't know.
Mm.
Because there are people in this world of political dirty tricks who do this kind of things. And so they're well paid enough and they know enough about the news business to insert flawed information in the process and get, in the same way the agent provocateurs you were talking about within these groups might create dissension. So in this case, they put in a document that looked like it was real. The guy, Bill Burkett, said it was real. And how are they going to know that there are parts of it that could be used by an orchestrated campaign to discredit what's essentially a true story and get them both put on ice? So there's a great irony that Dan Rather, who I've always liked, and he's done some courageous things on Iran-Contra and elsewhere, but he gets his start cooperating, maybe not knowingly, but he's being used on the Zapruder film, on the JFK assassination, and then he gets ousted when he's set up on essentially a true story that could have cost Bush the re-election in 2004.
Before we do pause, back to 9/11, I do see a lot of similarities between, and I haven't researched the Kennedy assassination like you have, but I do see similarities between people who know too much being knocked off, these phony commissions with people like Henry Kissinger put on them, that sort of thing. And I wondered if you had any other final comments on that.
Yeah, here's a very important part of this is what can anybody do? A call to action. I know people who are writing the president or the candidates and trying to get them to do things. And I just wrote one of these guys yesterday, he's a former CIA guy, very patriotic, and I said, we've got to believe what we're actually writing. These presidential candidates are puppets for the most. They're not interested in our policy theories on how to help the economy or anything else. What we've got to do is go to the grassroots, and here's the specifics, Cheryl. One is we've got to do things exactly like you're doing, which is support local media outlets where people, at least for now, can talk about these things. But the idea of writing a letter to CBS or the Washington Post, I mean, Dan Rather can't even get a fair hearing. You know, what are we going to do? It's a total waste of time.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's looking for the home run. Oh,
right.
If only New York Times would take my letter, then everything would be good.
Right.
Or if only Donald Trump would adopt my plan. Forget it. But the other thing, here's a real homework assignment for your listeners. And this stuff works, but it takes a little effort. And this is on 9/11.
Okay.
After all of these wars that are still going on and could lead to Lord knows what. I mean, literally World War III in Syria. If both us and the Russians are getting fighter planes in, and all presidential candidates on the Republican side, and also Hillary Clinton, want a no-fly zone, and they have nothing to say about how do you enforce it. What, are you going to shoot down the Russian planes? And right now, we're sending in planes whose only function would be to shoot down Russian planes if we have a no-fly zone. So all of this started over 9/11, and yet only 20 people in the House at this point are willing to declassify this secret report on who funded 9/11, supposedly.
What Andrew Craig was going to say, before we ran out of time, was to ask you to go to your Congress members and ask them to look at the 28 redacted pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry on 9/11 done in 2002. And I would like to add that if you do this, please share with your congressperson the evidence that the 9/11 Truth Movement has documented over the last 14 years. Andrew Craig, unfortunately, we're almost out of time.
I want to really thank you for being on the show today.
Any final thoughts in the time that we have left?
just that I'm thrilled to be back and talking with you, Cheryl, and congratulations on what you're doing.
Thanks, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people.